This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, one and all. Welcome once again to Meltdown Comics, the Nerd Melt Theater. Harmontown is now in session. Please welcome to the stage Mayor of Harmontown, Dan Harmon. Thank you. All right.
Jeff.
Yes, Dan?
We got guests. We got a guest tree growing in the back.
Our green room was chock full
our
of nuts.
Our green room is like a, yeah, it's like a, yeah, it's chock full of nuts. So let's get anything we got to say about me being fat, jerking off, and whatever.
You're getting a little rounder.
All right. I'm fat. I jerk off. I put some stuff in my butt once. I'm into women with the pantyhose.
Bubble baths?
Bubble baths. I love taking bubble baths. Hate NBC. Hate Tony. Love 12-year-olds in the back of my white van. Rape, hilarious rape.
We can end the show right now.
Yeah. Well, that concludes 20% of you. You can run off, go and blog. But we got guests to talk about.
I'm excited.
And talk to. I'm excited about both of them, really. One of whom we teased earlier because she wasn't here, and her Mr. Clean bouncer in the back kept going no. She's here. She's actually here. No idea what we'll talk to her about, but I'm excited that she's here because she's part of comedy history. And then another fella who I'm also excited about because he's like the version of me that's actually read about the things that I pretend I am interested in. So I don't know where to start. Let's talk about you. Where'd you get that suit? Who cares?
I was just about to tell you the rich history of the suit.
What you got anything going on?
Me? You know, Dan, I'm just living a happy life. I've traveled a lot recently, and I'm home. And I don't leave again until we leave together for Scotland.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah,
I have a lot of anxiety about. I'm working on Community, and it's like I've burrowed into this mud hole.
Community is a television show?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I have no idea. I'm at this point, my compass needle's spinning about the quality of the show. It doesn't matter. Who will ever know? That's whatever. That's my shtick. I have no idea. Could be best. Could be worst. Who cares? Now, no one ever wanted me to. Who cares, Dan, about how you feel about how good your show is or bad? It's stupid. It's a sitcom. Just shut up. But I'm in that zone where I'm like, I don't know. That's been like 6 months, and I keep thinking I'm going to finish, and then we're going to go off to Scotland. In between, Aaron's birthday. It's coming up very soon.
Is that – it's in a couple weeks, what?
It's December 5th is Aaron's birthday.
Same as my brother?
Same as my dad.
What? Really? My brother
– I propose a fan fiction story involving you and I at an 1800s orgy.
I'm almost certain that already exists.
In which we became our own grandfathers.
Is there a slash porn of you out on the internet right now?
I've never seen anything on the internet about that involved me doing it.
There has to be. Because there's lots of slash of me because of Who's Line. The Who's Line fans love it. I'm fucking Ryan and
Colin. You don't like
Colin.
It. You don't like it.
I mean, no. Because here's why. Poorly written.
Would you like me to write some slash porn? Would you like me to knock it out of the park?
That's not where I was going with it, but yes, I would. I would like you to write some really good me and Greg Proop slash.
All right. Well, I'll work on that. I gotta sit down.
Okay,
I'm not gonna improvise it.
I'll give you a better challenge. Me and you slash it up between you.
If that doesn't exist, I'm shocked. I don't know what we have to do to make it happen.
There's somebody did artwork of me and Dustin Marshall, our podcast producer. Just really gaying it up.
I saw some really flattering like. Actually, probably years ago, when we first started doing Harmontown, I saw some really flattering serialized fan fiction that wasn't slash. It was just fan fiction. It was about just our exploits. It was just me hanging out and then you hanging out. And I don't know. I was having misadventures and things. But
Somebody sent me a link one time, and you read the first couple lines, and it was me and Colin Mockery on a cruise ship, and then it instantly turns into just sucking and fucking.
I would welcome any of it. The reason I can't really read the community stuff because I think I've explained this enough, but the reason is because of scientific craftsmanship. Because if you were to write a community fanfic story about Annie finds a Rubik's Cube and there's a butt inside of it and it farts in her face, like if I were to mention Rubik's Cubes in an episode or something, we have to keep those worlds separate, otherwise what am I supposed to do? What could I do? Like, what would you want to have sent me something and then be the reason why I couldn't do that episode? Or would you want to be sitting there wondering if I ripped you off? Like, the only possible thing I can do is not deal with it. Yeah. Thank you, Dan, for... I was hoping he would talk for 10 minutes straight about why he can't read fan fiction. Now for our next segment, me cutting myself. And then drinking it. And then complaining about the taste. And spitting into a cup. And then tearing the cup. And then cutting myself with the shards of the cup.
Where'd you get this new cardigan? It's a new thing?
Aaron got this for me. And it's monogrammed. But they got the monogram wrong.
What's it say?
D-H-G? D-H-G?
They got the monogram wrong?
But it's still a monogram sweater, man.
Somebody muttered Gathy. Like she added like Dan Harmon Gathy.
Yeah.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Let's start bringing up our friends. I think I'm trying to figure out what order to bring them up in to maximize the impact.
Height.
Height's been suggested.
Water displacement.
I'm going to bring them up in order of how. First, we're going to do our feral audio. No, fuck that. No, I'm going counterintuitive. Fuck you.
Do it.
I'm going off the rails.
Follow your heart.
I'm following my heart.
Slash it up.
I'm bringing Lorraine Newman up first.
Lorraine Newman! Lorraine Newman to the stage.
You can sit anywhere and take any mic. Doesn't matter. No, you don't have to move down. It's the future. There's no more rules. You just sit anywhere
Anarchy.
You want. Yeah.
All right.
No idea what to talk to you about. That's one of the new things.
Well, we could talk about public bathrooms.
We were talking about that in the green room. I said, is there anything on your mind, like emotionally? And you said, you want to have a word with, but it sounded like your husband is one of these people.
No, it's women.
But your husband, in the meantime, in the men's room, he said,
I think it was the next guest who talked about the gap.
Right. Okay. Let's include what my husband said.
I've deafness, male deafness tunes out the
yes,
pitch that's women's voices.
Yeah.
I'm kidding, honey.
I really didn't
hear what he said.
You said in the green room you wouldn't mind talking about this. You called it the ski position.
Women, the women that think you can catch something from a toilet seat, so they hover.
Yeah.
You can't catch something from a toilet seat, but I end up sitting in your piss.
Right.
And it makes me hate you.
Yeah, like you don't want germs, so you're not going to sit on the toilet seat. You're going to be the Nikola Tesla of peeing in a public bathroom.
Lorraine, you're saying women hover so high that they piss all over the seat?
They don't even have to hover high, but they still piss on the seat.
Really?
Yeah, and no matter how much you put, you know, to cover the seat, it still comes through, and I end up sitting in there pee.
So
it makes me mad.
Does that force you to hover as well?
No, I refuse to hover.
You'd rather sit in strangers' pee than hover.
Well, there are times when it's deceiving because you've put, you know, you've laid something down.
Right. You've done
and
your
often
work.
You can't see it because of the lighting.
Yeah.
But then it's like, you.
I'm with Lorraine. I think that that's the last field of battle amongst each other. Mm-hmm. If we cannot touch with our asses the same
yes.
piece of plastic,
yes.
what are we even doing?
It's the end of civilization.
Until some scientist says, there's a germ that goes from your vagina and your butthole onto a piece of plastic and waits in a mall and
right.
jumps up into
it
you.
Can live.
At that point, by the way, there no one's going in a bathroom before that thing has taken us all out.
Right.
Exactly. So until then, like it's an altar when you go into a public bathroom. You have a choice. Like, and the people that have come before you, they've made a choice.
Exactly.
And they have changed the surface of the altar. And your husband, God bless his soul, but he is one of the enemy. Because he said he leans forward when he makes a poo-poo.
Wait, what? He leans forward.
He leans forward.
To what end?
To his end. And when I heard him describe it, I suddenly understood so many of the things that I have sometimes seen
in a
stall.
Leans forward to make a poo-poo.
So that you're not touching everything. So that you're
trying to
split the difference. Like you're on a fucking bench, like leaning forward.
I am not touching this part of the conversation. Let's move on to the people who are loading their cars at the market, but they're not telling you that they're not leaving when you're waiting for their spot.
Yeah.
How about them?
Right?
What do you mean?
Right?
There needs to be some sort of public pact where if you're not leaving, like, signal that. Somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah. Be a human being.
Wait, loading their cars?
With their groceries or something?
You're putting stuff in your car. Let's say you're at the market, and you're putting groceries in your car, but also you have to go to the dry cleaner next door or something like that.
Right.
And you're not getting in your car.
And you can see that someone's waiting for your spot.
And people don't say, hey,
I've lost Dan. I can see it. I've lost him completely.
Dan's not big on social cues like
But if I'm in my car and the meter's running. If I feel like someone's might be thinking that I'm gonna leave the spot and stuff. No, I'm very paranoid about that. My biggest nightmare, hands down, second only to bucket of spiders on the face, is the public movie theater. Save me a seat. Huh. I'll be right there.
Oh.
Save me a seat.
Yes.
Sold out movie. Mm. I gotta sit next to an empty seat. Or two. Or three. Sometimes there's three of you coming. Save us a seat. I can't say no because there's no...
Oh,
what
I'm
kind
so
of dick move
you.
Is that?
I'm so with you.
I gotta spend the 20 minutes of trivia slides about David Hasselhoff like before the movie
sweat.
Where people are like... People that, by the way, now history shows, will sometimes pull out an assault rifle and shoot mm-hmm. you, are looking for seats in the movie theater.
That's not why.
That's not why. I have never assumed that would be the case, but what terrifies me... people like and going it's seat taken. I'm cheating. Everyone wants
you,
sit.
You know what you do in that case if you have to, if you're forced into that situation, because again, yeah, you can't say no, I won't save you a seat. But what you do, a friend of mine, a comedian, Ted Davis, he said, on a plane or in a movie theater, when you have to save a seat, just affect a really wet cough. And just
that's
cough
good.
Just cough a lot, then nobody wants those seats.
Yeah, yeah. Or a variety of props could help out in that situation. But in reality,
which props would help out the most?
Well, like, you take these googly glasses and these are what I call my mile highs. I don't know. It's an audio podcast. Just imagine I'm wearing a prop that physically makes sense that a person next to you wouldn't want to. You ever want to scare a librarian? Lorraine Newman, you're 1975, you're on a variety comedy show that is not supposed to, I assume, succeed, or they wouldn't have put it on at midnight on NBC.
Right, like, it was supposed to replace the, instead of the Carson reruns.
Right. It's just, and it's
live.
A
filler, yeah.
Meaning, like, not meaning amazing. What is it now, 40 years later? I can't even keep track of time. But 42 years later, like, every fucking sketch is archived in this computer control. There's a robot arm that goes, dick in a box, goes, burp, zzz, October 2012. Why would that be in October? There's a Christmas sketch. But back in these days of Coneheads and these things, like... you guys were doing this variety show for us. Yeah. For you were bell-bottom jeans and like it was it, like but I don't have a question because I'm a bad interviewer. I'm curious if you have any insight, any.
Well, you want me to set the stage?
Sure.
Okay. Well, the first people who were hired in the cast were actually me and Gilda. And I had worked with Lauren before. I had done a Lily Tomlin special. And I think that was in 74. And he had seen me in The Groundlings. And then he came back and saw me doing more characters and more material.
Oh, who's he? Is
Lauren.
Okay.
And I went to New York and I met Gilda. And then we watched other people's auditions.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I met Danny.
With him, because he was like, you're my Charlie's Angels. Let's go
exactly.
Assemble.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what we felt like. And that was interesting. And then we started filming the commercial parodies. And that's where I met Belushi and Howard Shore, who was our band leader, who's now become an Academy Award-winning...
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, actually Silence of the Lambs, too.
Ah, fuck that.
Wait, Lorraine. So whose auditions did you watch that made it into the cast?
Jane Curtin.
Wow.
And it was between her and Mimi Kennedy. Do you know who she is?
No.
Oh God, I wish I could list her credits now. You'd go, oh my God, yeah, her. She was really good, but Jane, it was just clear.
So Lauren had the women first?
I think so. Yeah, and I think he did have Danny actually, and Chevy was hired as a writer. Garrett Morris was hired as a writer. And I met Tom Schiller, who was also a writer, and I'm thinking, God, that guy looks familiar. It turned out that we'd gone to the same grammar school, and my sister had been his camp counselor. So, you know, that was interesting.
It's already surprising to me because I remember from what I've read, like, you guys were all, I picture you guys as being all sort of in the same company. Like there was like Second City or something, and there's somebody coming and scouting and just grabbing people.
Well, the Groundlings had just formed the Groundlings like a year before I went to New York to do the show. I was the first Groundling to go and do SNL. So I cannot tell you the teasing I got from everybody in the cast, well, mainly Danny and John, about the Groundlings. So no, it was Second City from Toronto, Second City from Chicago.
So it was all just like, you guys, when you were showing up in 75, when you're shooting the first, can you remember the first sketch?
Yeah, well, I also remember the first sketch that was cut on George Carlin's show, which was Alexander the Great's high school reunion. And it was so funny. And I wasn't even in it, but I was heartbroken that it was cut. And, you know, there have been a lot of instances like that, and including, I think it was Jesus Christ's high school reunion where it was, Jesus, is that you? God, you look good. Christ, it's good to see you. No.
Yeah.
What was the joke at Alexander the Great's high school reunion?
Oh, that I don't remember. That's such a long time ago. But
just trust me. It was...
Yeah, or trust me, it was funny.
So you left the Groundlings in what year?
75.
I was born in 73. When I was 4 or 5 years old, my first professional job was at the Groundlings Theater. I did a play there.
Really?
Yeah. So it would have been just a couple of years after you left.
Wow.
I was in a very ill-advised production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, with all children.
Real children.
Yeah, it was a bummer.
Wow.
Yeah. Opening night, I was Linus, and my director, who is like 6'5", and I was, you know, a little tiny 4-year-old, and he gets down on his knees and on his haunches, like in the wings, right before I walk on. He's like, "Jeffrey, are you okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, why?" So he's like, "You don't look so good." And I just puked all over. I just projectile vomited all over his face, and then I dropped my blanket and went out on stage. As I think I said before, if you're Linus and you don't have a blanket, you're Schroeder. Nobody fucking knows who you are.
That's some pep talk. That's a great pep talk.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I owe that guy a drink.
Mm. And you were on SNL. Now we call it SNL. It never called it SNL back then.
Well, at that time it was NBC's Saturday Night because Howard Cosell had a show on Friday night with his rep company, Chris Guest. A lot of other interesting people.
What was the Howard Cosell show called?
It was Saturday Night.
Oh, okay. All right, so... So, anyways, you did it for what, five years?
Years, yeah.
How many episodes would that be?
I think it was 105 shows.
Jesus Christ!
And then Lorne decided he'd had enough.
You were there, so you departed. There was that year that Lorne Michaels got removed from his own NBC show.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, something like that.
I remember reading something.
Dan, where are you going with this?
I don't know. No, I really wasn't going with that. Was that 80?
Yes, 1980.
And so you left like...
The whole cast left.
Like Lorne came, could call you guys together and go... I'm interviewing
you
about stuff that everyone can read in some paperback.
Dick Ebersole, or was it Dick Ebersole? Someone from the network came and asked us if we wanted to stay, knowing that Lorne was leaving. Because Gene Demanian, who had been, I think, the talent coordinator, was going to take over as the producer. And we didn't feel that she could do it. So we all left. Wow. And I was homesick. I wanted to come home to L.A.
After 5 years of working on a show, even if you thought that the next person would do a bang-up job, it's like, it's a good time to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't be faulted for it.
Lorraine, what was your relationship with Chevy? Because Dan has worked with Chevy, and they've had kind of a famous, newsworthy
relationship. It was the last thing that we said in the green room. It was like, oh, the Chevy connection.
Yeah,
oh, Jesus.
We're not going to talk about it. No, I was friends with Chevy. We have a really great friendship. And when he left the show... I continued to be friends with Chevy.
You were notably the only person from Saturday Night Live, unless I'm mistaken, when he did that roast on Comedy Central. You were the one alum. You did a very funny bit that was like you read from your diary of having worked with Chevy.
Yes.
You were the only person there. And the story surrounding that thing is that he was pretty bummed out. He actually described...
Oh, it was awful. It was really... I mean, you know, his speech, you know, when he comes up afterwards was just... They cut most of it and they had to because it was basically... there was no material. Usually they have a bit where they roast the people that roasted them. But his was off the cuff. And it was just basically saying fuck you to everybody else, you know. And people who had artfully crafted a piece, you know. And he said, I'm only doing this because it's benefiting my wife's favorite charity.
Right.
So, yeah.
But is there something like you and I? It's like wait, I literally ran up into the stage because we had that one moment right before. I was like, "Oh, Chevy! Oh, shit! Would you be?" I think you and I get the sense. You and I feel the same way, which is like, no good can come of. We're not gonna. There's no shit talk like to be done. There's no like he is a fucking fascinating person, mm-hmm. and I worked with him. Longer than you did, not yes. to pull any rank or anything. But I've actually worked with him longer than anybody, which is I sometimes marvel at looking back on. And like I, the, like he, I, so
let me
magnificent, such an unignorable
tell
person.
Tell you a story about the time that I broke my ribs. Does anybody have anybody here broken their ribs? Anybody?
Only once. She's laughing at Chevy Chase.
Okay. It hurts like hell and takes forever
it
to heal.
It is excruciating.
And you can't sneeze and you can't cough.
Breathe,
you can't sit up and you can't lay down.
You can't do anything. Yeah. So forget laughing.
Okay.
All right? Now, it's a shame that they didn't include Chevy in the Aristocrats documentary because he tells it probably the funniest of anybody else because he acts it out. The Aristocrats joke.
He actually shits in your mouth.
Well, there's two of them. One is, I think there's a version that involves scatology, and then there's a version that involves incest. He does the incest one.
When you say he acts it out, he brings members of his family out? You know, no, he makes you he victimizes?
No, he pantomimes that. It's pantomime.
Is this related to the broken ribs?
Yeah.
This is years from like my having seen him. He finds out that I've broken my ribs. He tracks me down to where I'm staying, which is my boyfriend's house at the time. I'm still living in New York. And the opening line of the joke is guy goes to a booking agent. He tracks me down. I've broken my ribs. I, you know, fuck it. I just, you know, breathing hurts. I pick up the phone. No, hi, hello. Guy goes to a booking agent. That's my friend, Chevy. You know, now that's love. That's love.
He still calls me and vice versa. And it's all like he is focused on making people laugh.
And he's funny.
Yeah. And like he, I was at a hot dog stand out that sounds like I'm making it up. There was a hot dog stand outside the stage where we were shooting Community. Everyone's weary, everyone's bummed out, no one wants to be there, everyone wants to get home later. And the guy manning the hot dog stand goes, holy shit, it's Chevy Chase, who's standing in front of me waiting to get a hot dog. And I go, I'm thinking in my head, oh, great. Oh, fuck. Yeah. Please, come on. Don't talk to anybody. We all just want to go home. And he's like, what do you want? And he goes like, well, fuck, my sister's not going to believe it. So shit, please, let me call my sister. I just like, will you talk to her on the phone? And I'm thinking in my head, like, I don't even have the balls to be a man and say like, sir, excuse me, it's Chevy Chase wants his hot dog and we need to work. Thank God I didn't have those balls because this guy in front of me has worked for, you know, 1,000 years more than me who has the right to decline or absorb this thing goes like, yeah, give me the phone. And he takes the phone and it's like, it's right. And he goes like, hello, who's this? Natalie. Natalie, it's Chevy Chase. What the fuck do you want? And the hot dog guy is like freaking out. And Chevy Chase walks off down Paramount with the phone. And he's gesturing and he's, it's like 15 minutes. And I'm like, I'll have a hot dog with lettuce. And I have all that time to think about who I am.
Hot dog with lettuce.
I don't know anything about being a celebrity, and I don't know anything about eating hot dogs. I'm in autopilot mode. I have all that time to think about like who am I and who do I think I am and how are you supposed to treat people and what is any of this? Because Chevy Chase is walking off with this cell phone and he brings it back and hands it to the happiest hot dog guy in the fucking world.
And when he hands it back, he said, "What are we called? We're called the Aristocrats." And he gives the phone back.
But that's and he would do like if he was walking away from the soundstage, if he ever came across one of those Paramount tour groups or something, you'd pop by and he would be holding court like they're wow. popping pictures and he's talking because they ran across Fletch on Paramount lot. Anyways, what do you say? You don't say anything. I have no idea. You say the word Chevy.
Yeah, Chevy. I'm stunned. Well, you know, I have no idea what you guys went through.
TV comedy, like single camera comedy, after the advent of basic cable, after the advent of, anybody over the age of 55, on that set, like they are already being tortured. I think the Geneva Convention, if they knew what was going on for an actor over like at a certain point, would be like, you're not allowed to do this to human beings. Our crew, you know, like we abide by the union rules that we have to abide by, but the truth is there's inhumanity going on those stages and stuff. So
think exhaustion contributed to a lot of it?
I mean, if you're that magnetic a personality, how long are you supposed to stand there and be magnetic and be told that you have to do 20 more takes? You know, he was like not used to that at all. Like because it's like, fuck you, I'm Chevy Chase. What do you mean one more take? Fuck you, you got it. We didn't have it. But but he felt like we had it and it's tough.
But my guess is it wasn't fuck you, I'm Chevy Chase, you have it. It was that you're repeatedly asking for it. And maybe it made him insecure.
Oh, absolutely, God. Yeah. And it's like the horrible odd mirror that I would look into whenever he and I would like try to talk to each other about how we were dissatisfied. It was like, how do you say to somebody like, oh no, I know how you feel. Like, you don't have a right to say that. I'm like you. That is an insult to say that. Like, I'm 20 years younger than you. You're not. I'm not like you. I don't have a right to be like you yet. But like, the blood that's boiling in your veins. Like, it's boiling in mine too. But like it'll be funny if you act like it's boiling.
Was Chevy like that back in the old days? Back in the SNL days, was he like driven by insecurity then?
I think that's wiring.
Yeah, everybody probably was to some degree, right?
Yeah,
anybody on that stage, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was it? What was Bill Murray like? Because you saw that, then he came in, and from what I've read, the weird situation that Bill Murray was in was that people mistakenly perceived that he was the replacement for Chevy Chase, and he had to go through that whole thing.
Well, what was he like? in the context of thinking he was trying to fill Chevy's shoes, I don't think.
Or any context.
That he,
tell me anything.
I mean,
really.
I don't. I mean, I can't speak for Billy. He's a very enigmatic person, but you know, he's a great guy. I wish I had my phone with me. I could read some of his texts because they're hilarious. We have a great texting relationship. One of our you know, associates, a girl named Robin Schlein, who died a couple years ago from cancer. He said, well, I'll come over and fuck you. I think that would be, you know, a nice thing. You know, so he's just such a great guy. He really, you know.
What was the vibe like before you guys would walk out to start a show? You'd rehearsed it. You'd probably done did they still do the dress rehearsal for
oh yes,
so you did that. So before you guys were ready to go live and do it, what was the camaraderie, or the like, were you guys a team? Did you guys get together and have a huddle beforehand, or what was the vibe like?
No, you couldn't, because you were on all different areas of the stage,
right?
Which is strange, because we went and saw the show, I guess, 2 years ago. I had never seen it before. I'd never been in the audience before. And it was, I think Ed Helms was the host. And they've really blocked off a lot of sections of the floor, you know, which we used to use the whole floor as sets.
Meaning what? Because I can't even picture to begin with what the floor would look like. What do you mean by sectioned off?
They've closed it off, you know.
There's sets where you can't see everything from certain parts of the audience, so, right?
Well, they've used them. I think they're using parts of where, like, the bleachers are for the upstairs. We used, you know, some of that area was opened up, and we used it, the floor area, as sets. And now they're just enclosed. I think they use them for costume changes and wig changes and things like that. So they use very little of the floor now. And I think, you know, also they have just new technology that helps them along.
Did you get that feeling? Like, because I've gone back to theaters that I performed at when I was a kid, and you walk in there and you have that kind of weird, like, oh, shit, I'm on, kind of like for me anyway, I get like a weird energy of like you remember some of that, the old frights. What was it like going back and seeing a show there and not being like having to go out and do it?
Oh, you mean did I have like auxiliary stage fright?
Oh, no. What's it like to return there after years and see it different? Like, what was the emotional?
Well, they cleaned it up nice. The upstairs was always so ratty. You know, speaking of what it was like in the beginning, because, you know, we had all their shit furniture.
Right.
You know, like from the, you know, whatever floor that was
from the oral histories that I've read.
Let's give them that couch from Bob's.
You guys were punk rock. You were doing a variety show. The whole point was it was a variety show by people that were not supposed to be in charge of content.
Yeah, that was what was so exciting about it. We really felt like we were able to put on stuff that made us laugh. And we just couldn't believe the kind of stuff that we were able to put on.
The interesting thing is the constant question of when is comedy, because when you're laughing at things, there's nothing more subversive than that. And then at the same time, like, everybody loves to laugh, and that's why it's subversive. So then, like, comedy becomes institutionalized. I don't know what the fuck my point is or where I'm going with this rant, but it's like this was a punk rock variety show with a bunch of pot smoking, happy go lucky people just fucking around. And it was live. And it wasn't supposed to. The idea that you had cones on your head was ironic. It wasn't like, hey, let's get the cone. I don't know how to articulate it.
Well, I think that the reason it still is successful is because it's allowed to be idiosyncratic. You know, character driven stuff always works if it's a really original character. And I think that they pick good talent, and they have good writers. It's not always at the same time, but they've always had great people, always. And they've had tough seasons, and they've had great seasons.
Have you watched it consistently all the way through? Or do you?
No, when my kids were small, I didn't, and there was no such thing as TiVo. But now that there is, I watch it all the time. I love it.
Yeah.
Because I still love sketch comedy.
I mean, if today's SNL was held to the, or if I'm sorry, if 1975 SNL was held to the standard that we do now, where we go, okay, what were the two funny sketches? Let's put them on Split Cider and put a little clicky link in the thing. Like, it was a variety show, and you come in the description of that process is amazing.
Who was the coolest musical guest that you got to meet? I mean, for me, like, I don't get starstruck around actors or like famous people, but musicians always.
Me too.
Yeah,
me too.
Comedians, we all love rockers and musicians.
I'm the same way.
So who was the grooviest that you got to meet?
Ooh, David Bowie.
Oh shit! See, like, I'm straight, but I would make out with Bowie. I would absolutely make out. Like, right now, I'd make out with David Bowie.
Yeah, George Harrison, too.
Oh, Harrison. Yeah.
I mean, I'd make out with his ukulele there. It's almost more notable. Like who in those 5 years, who wouldn't have been on there?
What was Bowie singing then? Do you remember the songs he sang? What records was he doing then?
I don't. I just remember that Klaus Nomi and Joey Arias, who had been a groundling, and Tony Sales, who was my best friend in middle school, were in his band.
Just because he picked up local guys? Or?
You're just the Forrest Gump of David Bowie's. At that point, did you go, wait, is that what I am? Am I a cog in David Bowie's?
That's right. I'm Zelig. Yeah, I was just no, but I just wish they would have Skrillex on. That's all.
Hashtag Skrillex on SNL. That's
you were definitely there during some of the coolest era of music, like the talent back then.
Yeah, Devo was on, and Elvis Costello, and
I mean, for sure, back then that was you can't talk shit about SNL now, and it's like that's the thing, you can't talk shit about it. That's not cool. Like, it's a fucking institution, and now half my friends are on it, and or have been on it, and it's like it's an institution. How like your mind is torn in half by your relationship with SNL. A lot of the Lonely Island guys who started as Channel 101 guys and went to SNL and I think it was one of them that kind of summed it up. I'm sure this has been pointed out by anyone else, but they had said, you know, everyone has grown up on SNL. Everyone thinks that the SNL from when they were 10 years old was the perfect SNL, and everyone
Absolutely.
Thinks that the SNL from when they're 20 is a piece of shit. Like, yeah. Everyone has that luxury now. Like, it's been there the entire time, and you go, like, because, and I went, yeah, oh, yeah, Martin Short, Christopher Guest, holy
yes.
shit, those were the days.
They were great.
They were, but it's like, they weren't any better than anything. I mean, it's crazy to appraise seasons of SNL.
But it's also crazy to just say one season was better than the other because they were all different.
Yeah.
And there
is season 4 of Community, however, was a lot like watching it the season 20 of SNL be forced to watch season 1 of Chevy Chase's talk show on a beach. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I would, if I had my preference, you would stay up here for our next guest to come up, just because I think it would be interesting to have you up here, but you could totally leave too and pretend that you have a medical emergency or a family in pain.
But there's no dialogue between me and your guest, right?
No, there is. You stay there. You stay exactly where you are. That's why I think it might be...
Why don't I move over here and I'll... Because I'm really interested in what he has to say, I could hear out there too.
I say stay exactly where you are and just okay, good. I just wanted to make sure you didn't want to like leave.
No, I don't want to leave.
Okay, I'm kind of.
I mean, we are going somewhere after this, but yes. I don't want to leave now.
All right.
Are we supposed to leave, Chad?
No.
All right.
Remember that guy? It's the Lorraine Newman No guy.
Would you save a seat for me?
Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes he likes stuff. The Lorraine Newman No guy.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
All right. Well, let's... Feral Audio. Boy, we got a lot of podcasts on that network. This guy's got one of them. His name is Dr. PhD Dr. Chris Ryan. And he has a podcast called Tangentially Speaking. Oh, God! Sorry. No, yeah, please. Sit. There was that hang time where...
I'm glad Lorraine stayed. It's great.
I thought she
might... Now I can say I've been on a stage with Lorraine Newman.
Yeah. It feels important. I didn't want to blow her off, but also because you are the interesting thing about your book that you wrote. It involves monogamy versus polygamy in our species as primates. You are a guy whose PhD is in psychology, but you became kind of... You stumbled into anthropology, wrote a book, where you didn't have any horse in the race, but you kind of ended up making the case. And this is a very sensitive issue for people.
Yeah.
Myself included. Everybody gets their buttons pushed by this idea of, is humankind naturally monogamous?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a funny thing. Like, people want to believe that we are when all the evidence suggests we're not. So that makes it a conflictive kind of conversation.
But also in anthropology, then, don't you count the fact that we all want to believe we are as evidence to the fact that we are?
No.
Behaviorally...
That's the difference between science and bullshit right there. You summed it up. No, I mean, if you look... I was just doing a thing the other night with Amushika Escher and some comedians talking about science. And... yeah, I mean, the simplest way to explain human behavior is to say we're not a polygamous species, right? Polygamy would be one male and several females. That we're a promiscuous species, where both the males and the females had multiple sexual partners. So the simplest way to explain contemporary human behavior is simply to say we're a promiscuous species that's being told to be monogamous.
Right. And we can roll with that because of how promiscuous we are. It's like a Swiss Army knife being told you have to open wine bottles.
Right. but the blade comes out occasionally, right?
Yeah, we're still Swiss.
Yeah, we're still Swiss.
Yeah, and it's based a lot on humans are related to chimps most closely of all, and of those chimps, how do you pronounce it? Bonobo?
Bonobo. Yeah.
Here's where I lay my cards on the table. This is why I refer to you as the Dan Harmon of informed people. Because I read one book about this and pretend to be an expert on all this. And you wrote a book on it and probably read a million books on it and don't pretend to be an expert on it. But I read Desmond Morris's book from the 60s, The Naked Ape. And I think he was the one that talked about the bonobo chimps. And he talked about specifically how back in the day when science was still actually accountable to some degree to social propriety, when you're just studying chimps fucking, they had found this breed of chimps. Is that accurate to call bonobos a breed of chimps?
Well, they used to be called pygmy chimps. Despite the fact that they're not really smaller than common chimps.
Right.
They're a separate species. In fact, Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel and a bunch of other things, argues quite convincingly that chimps, humans, and bonobos are really three subspecies of chimpanzee.
Right, okay.
We're so closely related. If you go to the zoo and you see the chimps or the bonobos in the zoo, you are more closely related to them than they are to anything else in the zoo. Gorillas or orangutans.
Definitely.
Or what have you. So the chimps, humans, and bonobos are more closely related, for example, than the Indian elephant is to the African elephant.
Oh, well, okay. Right.
In terms of just genetic, like...
Last common ancestor and shared DNA.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're extremely closely related to them.
What percentage is our DNA linked to a chimpanzee?
Well, there are many different ways that scientists use to measure that, so numbers vary, but from 98% to 95.5% is the general range.
But also...
That's kind of a nonsense thing.
Because we have 70% in common with watermelon.
That half a percent? Yeah, exactly.
A watermelon is 98% water, like genetically.
So are we.
Yeah, exactly.
all I know is we don't have to go to work tomorrow. That's what I'm getting from all this.
Also, interestingly, speaking of not going to work, both chimps and bonobos sleep in hammocks, which I find really fascinating. I love hammocks.
In nature or just when they're provided them?
No, they weave hammocks every night. They weave branches together and sleep in
them. They create hammocks.
So we argue, Casilda, my wife and I, who's back there somewhere, argue in Sex at Dawn that hammocks are the first human technology.
I fucking love hammocks. I thought that was but when you get into a hammock, it feels so good.
It's perfect.
I thought it was because I had Asperger's or something. It's because I'm a monkey. Desmond Morris's book, and a lot of what Desmond Morris discussed, you know, has been subsequently questioned and challenged and stuff. But what he talks about is they discovered this type of chimp is really more closely related to us, or as you're saying, like they're like cousins of...
Well, they're equidistant
right,
from us
genetically. Right, like we both descended from chimps. And the interesting thing about them was always how much fucking and sucking they did. Like, they were... They are incestuous. They are bisexual. They are... He referred to them settling gang disputes through orgies. Yeah.
They're known as the aristocrats of the jungle.
They do it all.
Guy goes into a talent office.
They make the Kama Sutra look like an episode of My Three Sons. Like
Guy
they...
goes into a hammock.
and early in the 50s when they're discovering this stuff, they're sort of discovering it and going, weird monkey. And then over time are going, wait, that's us. That's what's going on. That's what's raging inside our brain.
Yeah, they're also the only other mammal that has sex face to face.
Right.
Right. They stare into each other's eyes. They kiss. They have oral sex. They exchange food while they're having sex.
Gross. Hey, that's gross. I don't like food and sex. Whenever there's chocolate
syrup. Talk to Mickey Rourke, baby.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Whipped cream. Yeah.
Yeah, like leave the food out of it.
Yeah. Franz de Waal, who's a very famous Dutch primatologist, said that chimpanzees use violence to get sex. And bonobos use sex to avoid violence.
Yeah.
In about 50 years of observation, both in the jungle and in captivity, no bonobo has ever been witnessed to kill or rape another bonobo. Not once. And believe me, if you're the first one to see it, your career is made, right? So they're looking for it.
That's the holy grail of primatology.
Right.
You just created a whole new weird payola scandal that's going to happen.
Bonobo rape porn. Yes.
Yeah. It's going to 30 years from now. Bonobo rape staged by yes. Dr. Sato.
Paid for in Bitcoin. Yeah.
So we do with that information though. Here's okay. So let's walk through the emotional experience that a human being with a necktie that's got to go to work tomorrow at 9 a.m. That loves his wife and loves his kids. What the emotional thought experience that he has when he reads a scientist saying that human beings aren't naturally monogamous. The natural experience is that person says, well, that is implying that my life is a lie. That's implying that.
Yeah, but that's a mistake. That's a very shallow interpretation. That's like if you're talking to a vegetarian and you say our ancestors were omnivores, is the vegetarian going to say, therefore, my life is a lie? I don't think so. I think most vegetarians would say, yeah, of course they were. That's why being a vegetarian is hard. But I still choose to do
right.
it.
We're also clearly descended from a lot of murderers. Like we bashed each other's brains in and slurped our brains from each other's skulls.
Not
we don't
so
have
fast.
To keep doing
not so
that.
Fast. I agree with the sentiment of what you're saying, but you know, people often say to me because I'm like in the business of talking about human nature, right? Which everybody's got an opinion on. People say like, okay, what is human nature? Are we naturally violent, as you're suggesting, like Steven Pinker suggests and others, or are we naturally
fuck
generous?
Pinker.
Fuck Steven Pinker. I know I've said that many times. But what the hell was they saying? Steven Pinker always sidetracks me. But the thing is, we are, there's all sorts of interesting research showing that toddlers of 6 months old already have a sense of justice.
Uh-huh.
And that, and one thing I often say is, look, nobody's walking around suffering from PTSD because they helped a stranger. Right? So no matter how violent you think we are by nature, it's interesting that we have to be trained to yeah. hurt each other.
Yeah.
And even after boot camp, it still fucks us up.
Right.
You know? So I think that the evidence is quite clear that we are by nature a species very interested in justice, in egalitarianism.
And compassion.
And compassion. That's our nature. We can, under extreme circumstances, be extremely cruel and nasty and bizarre, but that's not our nature as a species.
And what do we share? So what do we share that with? Who's the common ancestor that wants to rip throats out if we are actually, it's the chimpanzee, according to, if we're equidistant with bonobos
right.
from the chimp, then bonobos are like fucking and sucking and swinging. They're the 70s of right. chimpanzees.
They're the hippies.
And we're yeah. over here being like, you know, we're Devo going like, okay, we can do this. Let's just build
are
a couple
not,
more
man?
Skyscrapers and beep, boop, boop, boop. But we all have that grandfather, that great Santini above us, going like, get in there, get your ass in the dirt, private! Rip that throat out, tell that woman what's her job!
Dan, when is your book Mixed Metaphors coming out?
It's an album, Jeff. And it's going to be the book of movies.
So, what do you think is the final word on us? Like, are we
what's the final word on us?
Chris? No. Like, I believe so too. Like children in a sandpit aren't racist. We learned that. And also, I don't think we're naturally. I think we're naturally. There's a bit of competition and competitiveness in us, but I don't think that. Like you said, we have an innate sense of justice. I think there's other things that come along later on, like capitalism and governments, that we reward war and we reward conflict.
Yeah, property.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the essential difference. I mean, that's really what our book is about, is to understand that our species has existed for at least 200,000 years as an anatomically modern species, right? Agriculture only came about 10,000 years ago. So that's 5% of our time on Earth as a species, or much less if you include pre-modern species of human, right? So it's a very small percentage in any case. And before agriculture, the way societies were designed was completely different from the way it is after agriculture. Think about property. All hunter-gatherer people are what anthropologists call fiercely egalitarian. They share everything. And if you don't share, fuck you. Get the hell out of here. Which is why anthropologists have a big problem when they show up with a big box full of chocolate bars and peanut butter to last a whole year while they're doing their research, and they won't share it with anybody. The people are like, what the fuck? What kind of person are you? You come here. You eat our food. You ask me about my grandfather. You want to study everything, and you won't share your peanut butter with us, right? It's a completely different mindset. So,
then when they give them the peanut butter,
they're like,
okay, so how was the world created? From peanut butter! Oh, I love it!
It's true. Cargo cults.
That's another big
cargo
problem.
Cargo cults, yeah. There are people who believe that the gods give canned goods. You know that? But that's another story.
So how did it change when agriculture came along?
Well, agriculture introduced the concept of private property. And now people lived in settlements. They lived, they could accumulate property. So for the first time, men really had a reason to care about their paternity. Because, like, I don't want to leave, you know, this building
that
I've...
They weren't nomadic anymore.
They weren't... Yeah, exactly. They weren't nomadic.
It's so interesting.
That's when they took control of women, right? And that's when women became property. If you read the Old Testament, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, we all think that's like respect his marriage, right? No. Read it in context. It continues, nor his house, nor his slave, nor his she-ass, really, she-ass, nor his ox... Don't covet thy neighbor's property. And the wife is just part of the property. Right. So it's a huge change.
But so when people are hunting, when people are out there with spears, like, okay, they're like a football team running around. Let's go kill some mammoth, and we'll bring the mammoth meat back to wherever we're camped for the night. You're saying that's fiercely egalitarian because maybe the women are staying behind. I don't know if that's politically incorrect to imply, but I can't go back in time and see it. But you're saying that like the agricultural societies where there's like, yeah, we live in one place. We have a city. We're going to irrigate these crops.
And you can store grain. There's leisure time because you can actually, you can start to store crops and you can have a granary that, where you can live,
but that's also where math comes from. It's where astronomy comes from. It's where
leisure
civilization.
Time. But why? Yeah. Why? And I'm sorry. What's your first name again? I'm sorry.
Chris.
Why do women become property then?
Because when men have property, then they're very concerned with their paternity, so that they're leaving their property to their sons.
But why is it men that have the property when agriculture comes along?
Because the main advantage in agricultural societies is upper body strength because of the plow, that you had to be able to control a plow. Also, warfare became very important because agricultural societies tend to expand.
So they're protecting borders.
Right. So women in hunter-gatherer societies have equal or sometimes higher status than men. But women rule in a completely different way, through consensus, men in matriarchal societies get laid a lot. It's much better. For example, bonobos are female dominated. Even though the female bonobo is a little smaller than the male, as with chimps and humans, if a male attacks a female, all the females will gang up on that male and attack him.
So when you're running a plow and to be agricultural, you need that upper body strength. Men are doing, they're running their farms. They become the rulers. Then there's more time to build structures.
And specialization.
Permanent structures that last for a long time.
Right.
So then that's when you say patriarchy comes along with, like, let's make sure the hereditary, like the bloodline stays. Then you have rulers. And that's when men become assholes?
Yeah. That's when the inner asshole comes out.
I have to update my Joseph Campbell informed understanding of how this all worked was that it was these male-dominated football squads of the... I pictured, these cavemen in these fur loincloth, going, you take the left, you take the right, Johnson, go 20, go deep! And they spear these animals, and they take the meat back home to these little encampments, and then those encampments travel. And then those assholes go down to the equator where these... incredibly advanced societies have been formed, sometimes incredibly brutal, but advanced societies have been formed because they're able to, because they live in a more equatorial climate, they have created a society around the stars and the rising tide and all that stuff. And then these patriarchal guys come in and go, fuck you. You may be organized, but you don't know home invasion. Like we do, and they just take over, and they're idiots, but they own the alphabet. They're just like, okay, A, B, C, D, I guess. Like that was my understanding of it. But
is that what Joseph Campbell said?
That was the picture I got from him. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, you're right that the men generally, and it's not politically incorrect. It's accurate according to the data I've read that the men generally went hunting, and the women generally gathered. Now, what's interesting is that about 60 to 70% of the calories that people lived on came from the gathering, not from the hunting. Right? So, I mean, and there are all sorts of things we recount in our book. Like in the Amazon, there's a tribe, the Kulina, that have a ritual where when the men... Okay, so men don't like to hunt, generally, right? They'll go occasionally, but men are lazy. They're in their hammocks, right?
Right.
So the women have a ritual called the Dutsiet Bwane, where they, in the morning, the women will get up and they'll go around the village and they sing the song that it basically translates to, we want meat, you men don't give us enough meat. And I wrote to the anthropologist and I said, is there a double entendre there? And he was like, yeah, definitely.
Lorraine is casting a wry glance right now.
Yeah. So they go around the village and the women will, they'll go up to the man who's lying in his hammock and a woman will go and bang on the post where his hammock is tied. And this is not the woman he normally has sex with, right? And what it means is, if you come home with some meat tonight, I'll fuck you. So it's motivation for these guys. Like, oh, I get some strange if I kill a monkey.
I get some strange. We should rename our species to Hominis pivinus. Sorry, that's a Jeremy Piven joke.
Strange seeking missile.
Yeah.
So then the guys, if you're not into that woman, you can say, oh, my stomach's bad, and okay, they'll let it ride, right? But so then the guys will get together. Now in the Amazon, they hunt independently because the game is very sparse in the, it's monkeys basically, and they're spread out. So the guys will all leave the village together. But before they split up, they agree to meet at a certain place at a certain time. So then they go out. A couple of the guys will shoot a monkey. The others won't. They'll come back. They got a couple of monkeys. They cut up the monkeys. So every guy walks back into the village with meat. And they all get laid.
Wow.
And the anthropologist who wrote this in an academic paper at the end, he wrote, the Kulina participate in this ritual in very good cheer. Of course they do.
So now, as a guy who is delving into all of this, as a married guy who's in love with his wife and who has his own ego and his own what
meat did you get today?
when you come up against this this point where you go like, oh, this is how humans. How do you like we talked about this earlier. So our human species, like we, monogamy is. It may not be an instinct for us, but it's something that we want to do and that is worthwhile in that way. I'm asking you, as the guy who wrote the book and who is married, how you're coping with that information as it's coming in.
Why doesn't it change you?
Why don't you run out naked in the street and become the guy who's preaching the gospel of polygamy?
Would you like us to talk about Chevy again?
Has he run out naked in the street?
Yeah, like, if you're saying that we're not scientifically hardwired to monogamy, why is that something that's persisted? Is there a benefit socially for us?
It's an economic institution that's persisted because of private property, because it makes more sense and fits into an economic world that we've lived in for quite a while.
Now, okay, then I have another question. Since, like, you know, if that really is the roots of misogyny and male domination and grossness, why, since we aren't a hunter-gatherer society, and really we're not an agricultural society, I mean, we certainly need agriculture to survive, but we don't need upper body strength to survive anymore. Why does that male domination persist now? Is that just a hangover from that long ago, or do we know why? Women still get less money, and why we still treat women like shit all the time, and why does that persist?
Well, I think women are still subjugated in the sense that they're still seen largely as breeding vessels in much of the world, and in this part of the world until very recently. You know, adultery, as defined in the Bible and as defined in Western society until 20 years ago, only referred to the women. You weren't an adulterer if you screwed a single woman, even though you were married.
Right. And then you have the bastard son running around, you know, the Game of Thrones thing where it's like, it's okay to have your seed perched somewhere on accident.
In fact, it's advantageous. You know, it was a sign of wealth and power. So, I mean, there are a lot of lingering effects of this in Western society. And certainly if you look at, you know, Iran or Afghanistan, where women are still being stoned to death for the crime of having been raped. Right. It's insane. So women are still seen as property very much. And what we really rebelled against in our book is this idea that women are by nature gold diggers. Right. Women are by their very nature trading sexual access for, goods and services for men, for status and or meat and the ancestral environment or whatever it is. That's bullshit. Women were put in a position where all they had left to barter with was their sexuality. So, of course, they did in order to survive. Because if you had a kid as a single woman in Victorian England in Darwin's day, you were a piece of shit. You were thrown into the street and your kids would starve to death.
Yeah, if you're not allowed to be a senator ever.
Right.
And you don't have a penis. And you're ambitious.
So what do you do? It's a dead end. Survive. I mean, you try to survive. So, but what was your question? What do you do?
Well, my question was, what do you say to yourself at night as you go to bed next to your lovely wife, like, as you turn out the light and you go, I got my dog. Do you have kids? You're living the American dream. You got your white picket fence. You wrote a book that says that people want to fuck everybody.
Just look at them. Right?
So what's the follow up to that? What's the epilogue to that? To a happily married man?
The epilogue is that we all make our own decisions, and that, you know, as I said earlier about vegetarianism,
we also want to take a shit, but we do it in a toilet. We also want to pick our nose, but we don't eat it.
Why are you equating sex with horrible things?
Hear him out. Hear him out, doctor.
Well, I jumped. Go ahead. Finish.
No, I mean,
I assume that's what you were going to say.
No, I think, you know, people find their own compromises. People find ways. The only thing, we don't advocate anything in the book. The only thing, you know, is in terms of behavior, we only advocate compassion and understanding. And, you know, let's start from a realistic understanding of what sort of species we are. So we look at anthropology, we look at primatology, we look at human anatomy, particularly reproductive anatomy, the shape of the penis, the volume of the testicles, the fact that women can have multiple orgasms. I got in trouble giving a TED talk because Meg Ryan was in the audience, and I decided to go off script and talked about female copulatory vocalization. Right, and that really pissed them off.
She can't have a problem with that.
She doesn't, but the guy who runs TED did.
Oh,
yeah.
He was like, "I won't have what you're saying she's having." Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, there's also something to be said about monogamy in the context of children. I mean, you know, there's a lot of evidence of the destructive impact of, you know, a parent leaving, you know.
Desmond Morris's book, which is, again, it's totally the only anthropology book I've ever read, by this guy in the 60s who literally, that guy, I don't think in this book he said it, but he did say, just to put this in context, he did imply that that women's breasts evolved to look the way they did so that they would remind men of their butts.
That's called the genital echo theory.
That's just to put it in context.
To remind men of their own butts?
Like a lot of founding fathers of like theories that we end up building stuff on, they, you know, you put it in context, you're like, oh, you know what else Freud thought? He thought this. Like, you don't discount Freud, but it was a different time. Anyways, the that was the one book I read, and the thing that really stuck with me was this idea of pair bonding and neoteny. He talked about how humanity was in the crosshairs of nature, and we were going to be exterminated from the earth if we didn't figure out a fucking way to survive, and we had to do it through change, and we had to start emulating the pack hunting, like biological killing machines around us. And as we did, we had to really hunker down and stop being like these bonobos. I don't know if he knew they were called bonobos or not, but stop being like our forebears and start like making some changes. And one of those changes was we got to focus on the brain biologically. And because that makes a baby harder to take care of for a longer time, we got to focus on pair bonding. So we got to fall in love. We got to look at each other and we got to go, I'm going to have a baby with you. And when we have that baby with somebody, it's got to mean something, and we got to stick with them. And that all came out of our advancement, that as we started walking upright and as we lost our hair and as we started learning to use tools and as we invented alphabets, we were also learning to love each other, precisely because our children until an unreasonable amount of time, in the amount of time that it takes a kid to be able to beat off a wolf with a stick, you can have a whole wolf. That wolf that he's beating off with a stick is retiring. It's going like, I'm too old for this shit. So humans live until they're a very, very old age, and their childhood is like largely spent being a gelatinous blob of crying, snotty garbage. And so you need somebody to stick around and take care of it. And so we took that direction away from the bonobos. Like, you don't just climb up in a tree. You don't just like hit the hills when you hear a distress call. We took a different path, and part of that path was us going, okay, you and me, hey, you, Cindy, okay, yes, Carl, yeah, no matter what happens, right, for real, okay. and that became the people that felt that
Cindy
way.
Cindy and Carl.
At the dawn of time, the people that felt that way, and this is what's crazy, that's a crazy idea, that the people that felt, but then again, we have dogs shaped like corkscrews, but they're more genetically malleable, but the people that felt that way survived longer. That humanity that survived the ice ages and whatever the hell happened to us, there were the people that coupled up and said, like, I love Cindy.
But let's look at the unarticulated assumptions in that, right?
I think everything I said was totally scientifically airtight. I can't even begin to imagine in all the years of research.
Everything you said was articulated. I'll give you that. This is Little Pink Houses theory of human evolution. What is it? Jack and Diane, right?
Cindy and Carl.
Yeah, Cindy and Carl, sorry. What that assumes is that we evolved in nuclear families. Right? Casilda and I, in our book, we call this Flintstonization. This tendency to look around at the modern world and project it into prehistory as a way to explain and justify the way we are now. The fact is, hunter-gatherers don't live in nuclear families. They live in band-level societies of 150 people or fewer, in which they all take care of children. So I certainly agree with you that two parents is better than one. But you know what's even better? 15 parents. All right, like 20 cats. Parents. Right. And running around with a bunch of kids your age, a little older than you. A 7-year-old respects the opinion of a 10-year-old way more than the opinion of an adult. Right? So there are all sorts of things built into us as a species that are resonant with band-level societies.
Got it.
You know, Casilda, who grew up in Africa, told me this beautiful expression, the best place to store extra food is in your friend's stomach. Makes perfect sense. Right? There was no refrigeration. There was no accumulated resources. So if you went out and you killed a deer and you came back and you said, according to your Jack and Diane theory, I'm only going to share this meat with my wife and my kids, assuming right. you knew they were your kids somehow,
right,
you know,
right.
Because you're out hunting. How the hell do you know who she's fucking? Right?
I have a really weirdly shaped penis. There's absolutely no way the woman that beds with me successfully could ever let another man. That was my weird strain of biology. We're like the Habsburgs, but like, it's like a weird strain of DNA. Like it's like it looks a corkscrew. It's too that's too simplistic because that's like a lock that could be picked. It's like my penis looks like a common house key. And so did my great grandfather's. What were you saying? That's how I would know back then. That's how I would
so,
know.
So anyway, the anthropological data is very clear that hunter-gatherer people did not live in nuclear families. They did not live in sexual exclusive pair bonds. So this theory that like, well, the ones where the man stayed and took care of the woman. Right. Well, first of all, he didn't stay because he had to go hunting.
God,
secondly, the last thing he would do is share the meat only with his wife because that would get them all kicked out of the damn band, which is what they're depending on for survival. Sorry. And then you look at anthropological data, like, for example, in the Amazon and Papua New Guinea and other parts of the world, there are a whole bunch of societies that believe in something that anthropologists call partible paternity, which is that, you know, we assume that everybody knew that one sex act could result in a baby. That's not true. In fact, still today, lots of people don't know that. Darwin didn't know that,
right?
So, these people believe that a fetus is quite literally made of accumulated semen. So a woman, sorry to gross you out, but a woman who wants to have a baby, as all women do, that's smart and funny and good looking, will have sex with the smart guy, the funny guy, and the good looking guy to get their semen into her fetus. And then when she accumulates a certain amount of semen, then it starts to become a baby. And then when she has the baby, all of these different men will come forward and say, yeah, I'm a father. And they're all like, there are different words in the language for like the one who put it in, the one who spilled it out, the one who mixed it around. Yeah, it's like gangbang porn in the Amazon.
I have a partial right now.
The one who mixed it around. I don't want to be that guy.
I know.
That's the beta male of Papua New Guinea, right?
No.
Oh, no, you stirred it. You stirred it. Good job, Roger.
You go ahead. I'll be right there.
I want to be the guy that mixes it around.
I mean, Cletus is the reason he's tall, and, you know, Cletus? Tim's the reason he's smart, but
Cletus.
You stirred him. You Why? Stirred him together.
Every name starts with C in your tribe.
all right. Well, I don't suppose either of you two have anything to plug or anything to make worth your time visiting us. Lorraine, are you doing anything that you want people to know about? I want you to benefit from your time.
Let's see. Well, watch Metalocalypse, watch Garfield, watch... No, you don't have to watch Doc McStuffins.
Doc McStuffins?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
It's a reality show set in Papua New Guinea.
Yes. And they all stuff it.
It's about the guy who
they
just puts stuff in it.
I did an episode of Trophy Wife. I don't know. Yeah, I've got something called Box Trolls coming out in 2014.
What's Box Trolls?
Well, it's an animated feature. It's an English movie. Right. So, wow. So all I got...
I mean, you're shrugging it off, but what the hell is this podcast? What are we? I just want to make sure. Yeah, because we're honored to have you here. We missed you last time, and
it really is a pleasure to have you here. You've been a hero of mine for a long time. It's very cool to have you.
Yeah.
And when I say have you, I mean bonobo style.
And also come back anytime. That's a policy we have here. Come hang out, and you can take Jeff's place. It doesn't matter.
I'm the guy that mixes it around.
Let's also thank Dr. Chris Ryan. His podcast is called Tangentially Speaking.
Thank you, guys.
These are our guests. I'm a bad interviewer and a bad host, and I'm bad at dismissing people.
What's your book called? Sex? Sex at Dawn. That sounds like a Western.
I love that.
Sex at Dawn.
Sex at Dawn. It's a threat and a promise. Lorraine Newman and Dr. Chris Ryan, everybody.
First, go to his podcast, Tangentially Speaking, which is a Feral Audio podcast, which I'm sure if we listen to it, I'd be like, ah, oh, man. You know? I'm afraid to listen to it.
Why?
Well, because he, you know, come
you
on.
See, he's smarter than
the
you.
The elephant in the room, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like me, but he read everything.
You know, not only is Dr. Ryan sound like a fake doctor name. Dr. Chris Ryan sounds like, yeah. like something on a soap opera. He's smarter than you, and me and everybody. But he also he speaks into the microphone way better than both of us. He sounds like a fucking radio DJ.
Yeah.
And he sat like he was fucking born there. Yeah. Like he owned it.
But you know what?
He's right behind. Now he's looming ominously right behind. I like it. I want a doctor over my shoulder. I can refer to you in case of... Now he's caressing me tenderly.
I'm not a real doctor, though. My wife is a real doctor. If anyone has chest pains, talk to her.
Is that right? What's your wife's name?
Casilda.
Casilda, and she wrote the book with you?
Yeah.
Why wasn't she up on stage, you sexist motherfucker? Which sort of hunter-gatherer bullshit is this?
Well, he never said that he was against anything that he observed. He was like, yes, men own women.
He's sitting up next to me right now, thinking of which of the audience he's going to fuck later on.
And he's pointing at you.
He gave me a tender caress moments ago, and it will not soon be forgotten.
Jeff, should we go to the moon or have a nuclear holocaust, I would be honored.
I would say the first.
I would be honored if you would be the one that mixed it up.
Dan?
In my new family.
Dan, if you'll put it in, I'll mix it around.
Speaking of which, let's bring out Aaron McGathey.
From the world's worst segue department.
Have you had any thoughts listening to all this?
Yeah, sure. I have to say, I was really sleepy, and I love Dr. Christopher Ryan. I've actually read his book, Sex at Dawn. It was recommended to me before he had his podcast, but I fell asleep for the last 10 minutes.
Oh, that was probably my fault.
No. It was no boredom. I was just sleepy, right. And comfortable. And there's an intern back there who she complimented my dress and then fell asleep. And I was like, I want to take a nap with her, so I fell asleep too.
It's happening as he's talking. It's tribal.
You guys created a hammock back there.
Yeah.
Should I come back and mix it up and give it a little here and a little there and.
Women thought a baby was made by combined semen, by fucking everybody, and a baby would turn out funny, smart, tall, clever, this or that. And there was one guy's job just to get in there. And I'm like, look, the baby's tall. He's clever. I'm not. I just mixed it around.
I immediately thought
I'm the kitchen aide of
a
baby man.
That title was reserved for the guy that they couldn't figure it out. They're like, oh, he's handsome like Tim, and he's strong like Kyle, and Steve. I'm sure you really made sure that Tim and Kyle were both equally represented with the back and forth motion of your tiny little plunger.
The way I heard that, that was not a beta male thing. It was very alpha. The guy's like I went in there. I was so secure in my masculinity that I just went and mixed all that cum up and fucking stirred it up.
Here's the crazy thing. Do you ever wonder, like, how the fuck did human beings ever figure this out? Because I guess they had nothing else to think about and no other data to collect. But I just learned that with cats, that's actually true. Mm-hmm. Like, a couple different cats can fuck a female cat, and a litter of kittens actually represent different...
So cool. It's so insane. Neat. You can have a whole baseball team.
How back then... I guess I kind of understand. Like, it's just amazing to think of what they were going through back then at the dawn of our species and how they looked at men and women and well, I guess I'm... It's like them... First of all, figuring out, like, oh, that thing I do that I really want to do, and then that stuff that comes out when I finish doing it, like, oh, that's like seeds, and you're like dirt. Because sometimes, like, them making the correlation that 9 months later, sometimes...
Did you ever have a sex talk, like a formal sex talk?
No, my mom...
Did your dad hit you with a sex education book?
My mom said to me at one point that this is as close as verbatim as I can get, and I've apologized to my mom. She's a great mom. I don't think she's listened to the podcast anymore, but... My mom at one point said that sometimes when a man looks at a naked lady, his penis gets excited and stands up and dances around and then white stuff comes out of it. And I went to the bathroom after watching Debbie Does Dallas with my older brother. He would invite the neighbor kids over to watch. He would charge them to watch Debbie Does Dallas because my dad had it on VHS. It's a porn, you fucking 25-year-old. You big sausage pizza generation. We used to have story. Debbie didn't want to do Dallas. She had to. Mr. Greenfield earned it. I was like pre-pubescent and watching the big kids. The big kids would watch it. And I went to the bathroom. I've told this story a million times, but I went to the bathroom and we all, this is the 70s, everyone had tidy whitey briefs, that's all you wore, and there was some cotton lint on my wee-wee that I was absolutely certain, I looked at it as I was going to the bathroom, and I went, oh my God, my penis got up and danced around, because I looked at a naked lady, and that's the white stuff that came out.
Do you think there was a man in your penis, like The Shining?
I thought that my penis was like a man that danced right. around. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm not kidding.
Interesting.
Yes. That's how she described it to me.
I grew up in a very religious family. When I was 6 years old, my mom and I went to a carnival. And I don't remember the details from the carnival. I remember when we got in the car, I was holding a $5 bill, or which one is Lincoln on?
Five.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm just double checking. So I was holding this $5 bill, and we lived in Italy, and I didn't have like American money, but at this
or a penny. It could have been a penny.
It was a bill, and I hadn't really seen American money, and I was like, ah, this guy, like, to get on this bill. We're driving home. I'm like 5 or 6 years old. Ah, it's amazing. Like, he got on this bill. Like, where did he come from? And my mom said, well, when two people love each other very much, the female will arouse the man so his penis becomes an erect. Yeah.
Why?
This is how I thought. And I was like, I didn't know. That's not what I wanted.
What dots was she connecting there?
I think she was just waiting for it. She was really excited. My mom was very like academic and was just waiting for her chance to tell me about sex. Also, she always liked scaring me, I think, a little bit. So I was just like, this guy, Bill, what a night at the carnival. Like, I remember as she was explaining this to me, I remember looking at fireworks going off in the background as she was saying, well, when a man and a woman love each other very much, the woman will arouse a man so his penis becomes erect, hard like a stick. And then the stick goes inside the woman, and if he's excited enough, his ejaculate will go into her, and if it fertilizes the egg...
She called the dick a stick, but she used the word ejaculate? It's a weird term to get clinical.
Well, our dog was named Ejaculate, so.
Okay.
We sat in silence the rest of the way home, and she kept on asking me if I was okay, and I was like, it was fine. But I misunderstood the talk, and that I thought that, and I think a lot of kids think this, I thought that the penis detached and you plugged it in like a gas hose. So that's what I was thinking.
A gas hose?
Well, like, I imagined my... A gas pump. I was imagining my parents lying next to each other and my dad being like, honey, is it time for another McGathy child? And him just being... My mom being like, yay, a baby!
That's like
I was celebrating Abraham Lincoln being on the bill.
Meanwhile, I thought women had nothing to do. I thought that when a man looks at a woman, his penis is like just goes, woo!
You guys are lunatics. Mom, how does a bill become a law? Well, when a man loves a woman, his penis turns into a man, detaches like a gas hose, and pours ejaculate into her.
I do remember when I was 6 years old, as we were driving home, and I had presence of mind to be like, this is fucking crazy that she told me about this. I really feel like this is too soon. I wasn't allowed to watch an R-rated movie until I was 17. So I knew everything, but nothing at the same time. But I had this moment where I was like, just remember this. Whenever you look at Abraham Lincoln or a $5 bill, you're going to remember where you were. And this is the first time that you are making a memory. That was my thing. I was like, this is my first memory, which doesn't make any sense. But still, every time I look at a $5 bill, I think about my mom and my dad. Fucking.
The first time you were scarred.
Yeah. Well, that was not the first time.
All right,
good.
Come on.
Heavens.
You guys...
Come on. Dan, I think I may have taken my nap before because I've...
You slept during a fucking fascinating interview.
Oh, no, I loved it.
When you're back there before the show, you're just snoozing?
No. It wasn't for very long. It was really because there was a nice lady who complimented my dress and I just wanted to take a nap with her. I mean, that's really what happened. Thank you.
Oh, I know. I think you were just tired.
I was also just tired.
Yeah.
But Dan is meeting my extended family on Wednesday, my very southern extended family, and I started thinking about how soon that is, and I started getting really like nervous and overwhelmed. So I've been distracted by that, but not in a bad way, in an exciting way.
Did it make you sleepy? Don't
you get overwhelmed and then sleepy?
Yeah. Well, okay. Well,
let's get Spencer up.
21 minutes.
Spencer, get up here.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Here comes cranky Spencer. Here comes cranky underdog Spencer.
What was that?
There's not enough time to play proper D&D.
I love that. I love not having to write new things next week.
He is truly my protege. I've been training him in the art of not liking working.
Spencer, I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say that you're going to be in an episode of Community, right?
Yeah.
Am I Dan? Is that bad?
It was also mentioned a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, we
on
talked
the show.
About it at
yeah.
length.
Yeah, you were there.
I was not there. Did you enjoy your experience on camera?
I had to think about that. Yeah, I enjoyed it. They, I think 2 weeks ago we also said Danny and Allison, so they were really nice to me. I'm awkward. I don't talk to people. I don't make eye contact. I don't know what to say. I don't know what I'm saying right now. But they made me feel like almost a regular person. And more than that, almost a regular person that might have supposed to have been there.
Wow.
And, yeah. And it was amazing.
Spencer, whether you like it or not, you've been thrust into the limelight. And you've become a beloved national treasure.
I'd like to think so.
All right. Now do your job.
Get those character sheets out.
Roll your dice, dice boy.
I haven't played D&D in a few weeks. I want you to know that I've really been thinking about my character the last couple of weeks, and this is going to be really good from me. That I'm going to be very committed to my character, and I'm going to really play this. I'm not going to be stupid.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Please do.
I have to pee so bad.
We got this. Just go. It'll
go
be quick.
Pee. Yeah. We'll cover it, Dan.
No.
I'll play your snoring while you're peeing. Do you want that?
Will you play for the... But then that's the whole show. That's the closer.
No, we'll play it. We'll talk about it next week.
Aaron recorded me snoring. No.
Let's save that. Go pee. Are we, should we play snoring while you
pee? Just while he's peeing. Go pee.
Okay,
get the hell out of here.
It's 9:41. Let's see how long it takes Dan to pee.
I have two videos. I have a video of Dan snoring, and then I taped him while I was trying to gently adjust him and what he said to me.
Gently adjust him.
Well, because if he's lying in a certain position, he snores really loud, but any other position, he's fine. So I was just trying to like move the pillow a little bit, but this is him snoring.
Will the audio work here? One helps.
Bottom.
a wildebeest?
So this goes on for a very long time, and I'm going to play the audio of me just trying to move this pillow so he could stop snoring.
Hey.
Steph,
what's wrong with you?
All right, I'm going to pause it. I'd like to say that I didn't get a very good...
If I'm ever dating somebody, and I am right now, but like if I snore like that, I would want someone just to fucking put a bullet in my head.
Dan has been working such long, hard hours on Community and is so tired. He's working so, so, so hard. And this was, I mean, he's barely ever home. He sleeps at the office. And last night, he kept me up. And this is, I wasn't angry, but kept me up.
Dan's back, everybody. Dan's back. Shit, a minute and a half. Not bad at all.
He was snoring so loud.
I didn't wash my hands.
He kept... Stick them in my mouth. Stick your hands in my mouth. Sorry, cue from home. He was snoring so loud that he kept on waking himself up with a snoring and be like, what? What, Aaron? What?
Did you hear it? Did she play it?
No. Yeah. Everyone started laughing.
You couldn't hear from the bathroom? You pee that loud? You couldn't hear your own snoring?
So really quick, this is 45 seconds. We'll have to hold our breath because it's pretty quiet, and then we can laugh after.
Steph, what's wrong with you? What?
Nothing. You're snoring all day.
Oh, okay. You know what? I don't want to fight. I'm not doing anything wrong. I just need you to understand. Do you have any idea how little sleep I've gotten over the last...
I know. I'm so sorry. You're just...
If I do something wrong,
It's not anything wrong. It's just an adjustment. It's not sleep apnea. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Fucking low-level sitting Nancy.
Mike, keep snoring. It's fine. Keep snoring.
Hey, listen. I may be asleep right now, but I want to wring your soul like a fucking rag. I want to drink every drop. I don't know if you understand, while I'm sleeping, how much energy you need to put into me sleeping.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, don't be sorry.
I woke up feeling terrible. Because the truth is, honestly, like, that was a weird... It was a weird night. That was a weird night of catching up on a lot of shit. And I hope that was unusual. I don't want it. It was unusual.
No, I mean, that's the reason why I taped up. I don't have a backlog of what if I did.
Also,
I'll start doing that.
Also, I don't want to think that I snore. Maybe I do. Maybe I don't. But I wouldn't want someone to fucking record me. Don't record me while I'm fucking sleeping.
Well, I don't mind. I'm kind of interested in that. Like, because it's the one thing you'll never hear. It's so interesting. Like, that's truly like you and your most. Like
I used to
that's
tape
like
my
seeing
dad
the back of your
snoring.
Head in a mirror. You know, it's like this weird. Like that's what I totally. Sound like when my body is. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. Spencer, let's play a little D&D, shall we?
Yeah. Last time on Harmontown.
And you know the thing about that Meerkat show?
Sorry.
You invite me here. You tell me to do stuff.
Sorry.
It's cool.
What's on everyone's Christmas list?
Silence.
I feel like Hollywood has changed Spencer.
I think being comfortable here has changed me into being less agreeable in general. Which is my natural state, to be fair.
You're starting to realize that what you're doing is technically labor.
I mean, starting to?
For Christmas, I'm getting Spencer a belt that's just one of is that table.
I don't get it.
Spencer, just to change things up, I want you to do an intro D&D, but I want you to do it to old-timey striptease music.
If it doesn't give us a boner, you did it wrong.
Well... I've already failed. I don't even know.
So welcome to the stage, Spicy Spencer.
I'm already here. I don't... for the podcast, all lights have been cut except to me.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening.
It's called the special. You have your light now.
It's called burlesque.
It's Hollywood, man. Take your fucking shirt off. You want fame? Well, fame costs, and right now is where you start paying.
I don't want any of this. I never did. I just want to pour vodka and sit in a corner.
Do it.
Okay. How much time do we have left on this music, Jeff?
Just 2 minutes.
All right. Last time on Harmontown, nothing happened. I will leave. I will... I mean, honestly. It's your guys' name on this.
Yeah, come on.
Well, it's just one person, same.
I mean, sure.
I think we're just feeling guilty that we ran up the clock, as usual. So we're trying to make a joke out of it.
Sometimes when it's dark, I kick my cat. Because I just bump into it. And I don't think, oh, sorry, let me kick you a whole bunch more times while laughing gleefully. That'll solve this problem.
Well, does your cat seem like part of him kind of likes it a little bit?
Depending on where you kick it.
Oh, yeah. I have a socks on.
What? 1 minute 20 left in this track, Spencer.
Just go for it, yeah.
And this is what, take four? Yeah. All right. Last week on Harmontown, as I said before, literally nothing happened. There was, it was a different Harmontown. No D&D happened.
Oh, right, right.
But the time before that, however, our heroes were locked in combat with Admiral Darkstar. You see, the climactic, anticlimactic combat involved face-sitting, wire saws, and dismemberment discussions on the seemingly helpless Admiral. And after attempting to reason with the Dark Lord, he revealed that were he killed, he'd grow much more powerful, perhaps more than they'd ever imagine. But heeding not Darkstar's words, our heroes settled on decapitating him via wire saw, and Krista Berg began his grisly work. As he sawed, a foul oozing miasma began spewing from the dark armor, filling the room with a vortex of evil energy. But after a moment, it dissipated. Our heroes began to celebrate their victory, but their jubilations were cut short by a massive metal claw bursting forth from the floor below. A four-fingered Ferris fist snatched Quark and lifted him high into the air in its cold clutches. And yeah, that's what's happening. Right.
11 minutes of role playing. going to be the most intense role playing you've ever had.
Okay, so I'm being held up in a big fist.
Yeah. So you thought you killed this guy, and then all of a sudden this hand bursts out of the ground, cracking the stone floors all around you, and it grabs Quark and lifts him up in the air like some sort of thing holding Quark up in the air.
I try to wrestle myself free.
All right, that's probably a good opening move.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Oh,
you try to squirm out of its grip, but its vice-like claws hold you tight in place.
Help me!
Teleport cloak.
Yeah.
Yeah, up to the top of the thumb of the hand holding my friend.
You wave your teleport cloak, and it gives a... It seems like it's run out for the day.
Quark, I'm going to put on my boots of springing.
Okay.
You relax. Save your energy. All right. You look very weak.
I'm being crushed by a giant hand.
Yeah, I know. Shush. I put on my boots of springing, and I take a deep breath. And, you know, in baseball players, if they make eye contact with something, it works better. So I do that. And I jump. I use my boots of springing.
To try and jump
up and release him. Because I have a whole basket of crafts and a lot of ideas. I just got to get up there.
All right. You spring spryly atop the hand. You land between the second and third fingers, kind of on the joint of this hand. You're kind of standing above where Quark is with your basket of crafts.
All right. I'm about to destroy your handiwork, sir. No.
I liked it.
Can I do anything else?
What do you want to try? It depends. You could start doing something else, to be sure.
Okay. I'm going to prepare something for my next move, which will be...
Being crushed by a hand.
I'm going to. I
sit there while I'm in crash and I watch her prepare something.
Do I have antifreeze?
No.
Okay.
You have cheese.
Alright. Isn't that our other game where I have all the cheese? Or I have a lot of cheese here too?
It's a craft supply.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay.
I could hear Adam getting that.
Okay. I take out two pieces of plastic sheeting from my craft area, and
K-R-A-F-T.
We've released Adam.
Someone put a nickel in.
I'm preparing something. I take out two sheets of plastic sheeting, the cheese, some string, and a hole punch.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
All right. Plastic doesn't exist.
What?
Plastic doesn't exist.
Plastic doesn't exist.
Neither just preparing stuff right, for the next
okay,
round.
Okay, well, then I'll wait for my next turn.
All right. I'll put it at Dan's turn since his magical item.
We all want to do a bunch of stuff.
Do it.
Gaseous form.
Waving your arms around, you dissipate to a gas.
Dissipatus formatus.
You now occupy the room like some sort of fog or mist.
Yeah. Well, guess what? I'm moving up into this robot's face.
Well, there's only the claw.
Oh, the claw? I projected a robot with my mind.
I mean, who's to say there's not a robot?
Right. I mean, a big robot hand came up, grabbed my friend.
Yeah.
All right. I'm a gaseous form.
Yeah.
I'm going to... Can I do something?
You can exist in a gaseous state. What does a gas do? It dissipates. It sits. You can't do anything as a gas, dude.
I can't move.
Well, you're
a gas.
Yeah, you could drift.
Can someone please make a T-shirt for Dan that says "Exists in a gaseous state."
I can't move.
Dan, the one who cast it, blast it.
dumb.
You can drift around, but yeah, that's about it.
I drift around to the robot's
face. I'm being crushed by a hand. You guys are putting out plastic and cheese and turn it into farts.
I drift down through the hole that the hand came up
through.
Okay.
I'm going down through the hole that the hand came up through.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I get it now.
Does it?
Yeah.
It makes more sense.
Okay. It makes 80s hero sense.
Flowing through the cracks in the floor, you go down a level, and there you see a giant robot man.
See?
With his arm through the ceiling.
I get up in his grill.
You surround his face gaseously.
Yeah.
Now you become a 90s hero.
So welcome
to Earth.
The quirks.
The claw starts flailing around, and it smacks Chris. No, Quark. Sorry, Quark. Into the ground, all body slam style or something. Geez.
Does he release him?
Fly swat style.
Yeah.
I mean, he opens his fingers so that he could get the crushing thing going on.
Get out of there.
Yeah, he does, actually.
I get out of there?
At the last second, as the fingers open, you dive out of the way and miss being squashed very narrowly.
It's because I'm nimble as a fucking mountain goat.
What am I doing? Because
You're preparing crafts, I believe.
Yeah, so...
Am I still on the fingers?
You'd be in front of the fingers at this point.
I've been what?
You're now in front of the fingers on the floor as the fingers are on the floor.
I see, okay.
Like that.
Yeah.
Like that.
Is that my turn?
For the podcast. Yeah.
Barbarian rage, mighty sword attack on the hand. I try to slice the veins on his wrist like a cutter. Bleed this dick real slow. And as I do it, I take my sword and I go, I'm gonna make you leak, Jack.
Wait, so are you quipping wittily or raging?
I quip ragily.
Okay. The true meaning of what you were trying to say doesn't come across entirely, but being a robot hand, you don't suspect it matters. But you slice into his finger with your mighty sword and cleave one off. It seems to do...
I went for the wrist.
Oh, the wrist? Yeah. Well, you don't cleave it off then.
Oh.
You do just deal some serious damage.
All right.
Is there extras 1d6s on you? This is so boring.
Anybody got 1d6?
Talking about math.
It's 2d8 plus 8.
Yeah, gotcha.
Crits 19 to 20 times 2.
He's asking for dice.
Yeah, for dice. No, I got the dice. The dice.
Sweet.
That would you always got the dice.
22 damage.
Fuck yeah! Oh, freak out!
All right, is it back on me?
Were you just trying to end the show?
No.
I thought you were like, yes, yes, and then everyone just killed the momentum.
No. Fuck. I
end the show.
I would do this till 11.
I
want to find their limit.
I take the supplies that I had gathered before, not plastic, string and cheese. I make eye contact with the room. And I smash it, and I put on my armlet of summer, mm-hmm. my flaming armor that can heat up metal. Woo! Yeah! Yeah! That's you guys. Yeah! So good! So good!
We'll edit their silence out.
So with my armlet of summer, which I'm assuming like fires up, so it looks like I'm on fire, right?
Yeah, like not completely human torch, but pretty much there.
Okay, all right. Hey, look! I say to my friends, and then I'm going to charge the. Can I charge the? Is the heart exposed?
Not from this floor. You'd have to pop down to the lower level there.
All you have is the hand coming up through the floor right now.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and pop down, but can I pop down by sliding down the neck like a Ghostbusters pole? So it's kind of like, okay.
Yeah, you can. It's just the arm, not the neck.
Right. Okay.
But yeah,
right,
definitely.
The neck's not out. Okay. All right. I'm going to slide down the arm, but I'm going to nuzzle it as I go down so as to create as much damage as possible.
With a damaging nuzzle, you slide down the metal arm. It doesn't seem to do very much because it's metal. But you do slide down the arm and find yourself on its shoulder, right next to the giant robotic head.
Cool.
You got an attack action or something.
Oh, I do? Yeah. Oh, well, then I'll take my flaming arrows, and I will fire my flaming arrows into the robot's eye and the other into his neck. Because he'll be like, what is happening?
You fire your arrows at point-blank range. They both smash into the head, except one of them seems to, like, bounce off the head, and it just plinks off the armor. The other, however, pierces through and goes into the brain. You can see, well, I mean, the robot brain. I don't know what you call that. A computer. Right.
The positronic module.
Which doesn't exist in D&D.
However, according to Asimov,
it's the soul matrix. The soul matrix emits sparks, and he takes 12 damage.
Brain damage, though.
Oh,
that's
plus fire.
Extra.
And I say, I'm on fire! That's...
The laziest mic drop of all time.
Well, I don't want to hurt the mic.
But the most compassionate.
But you thought you could
drop.
Do damage by nuzzling?
Oh, well, I mean, have you ever slept next to Dan Harmon?
Hello!
Look, I don't want to get in a fight. I just need you to understand how high the stakes are when I'm sleeping.
Also, the night before, where's the treasure? The treasure's here. You gotta get the treasure.
Where's the treasure?
I was talking about treasure. I was breaking the finale story in my sleep. You're welcome. That's how hard
guys,
I work.
Guys, we're close to the finish time. We have to come up with a cliffhanger here. Let's focus.
Sharpie's turn.
All right, so I'm gaseous form, and I'm up in this guy's grill.
Or that right? T-shirt.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm going around back of his neck. This is what I do. This is my thing. I'm going to stop being gaseous form, and I'm just going to be on his neck. No, wait. Can I go into his body because I'm gaseous?
Yes.
Can I edit the podcast to make it seem like I knew that already?
Yes.
I'm thinking, oh, I'm gaseous. I should be on his left shoulder. I go inside his robot body as a gaseous form.
Holy shit.
Okay, that happens.
You're like Dennis Quaid in Inner Space.
Yeah. I'm like the left half of Timothy Hutton in The Dark Half.
Thud.
That's Timothy Hutton's fault, not mine. That's how he ended up on TBS.
Yeah, so you're inside of him. Did you want to do anything else?
Yeah, I want to look around. Like, no, what's
do,
up?
Do an attack. You have attack damage. Shit.
What do I see in there? Am I gaseous or can I see?
You could. You're gaseous and you can see.
All right.
You see a bunch of...
expand yourself as much as you can.
What do I see? How can I see? I'm gas. I don't have eyeballs.
Well, that would take a lot longer but you see a lot of stuff you don't understand because it's magical robot shit, and you're not like a magical robotician.
But I know what a heart is.
You sure do.
I know where the power's coming from.
Well, you see a weird glowing thing. You see a lot of weird glowing things.
I see something glowing more than other things.
Nope. They're all glowing equal.
No, I do.
They're different colors.
I see something red. I see a red thing.
Okay.
I see it glowing bright in the chest area. And I gasp my way over to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Dan, you can't just tell him what is there.
I am... having a moment here with Spencer. I go to that, and then I reform around it.
Okay,
punching it.
I see a purse boutique.
Punching. Okay, so you flow in, and you stop. You see what is a red glowing thing inside the interior of this machine. You recorporize,
yeah,
and you start punching it.
Well, I mean, let's you know, if you want to get specific about what I'm doing, there's obviously cords, wires, valves coming out of it.
There's not. There's a glowing red thing, but that's it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Then yes.
I mean, there's more glowing things. There's no cords or wires.
All right. Then I mean, how long is this move? I recorporalize and I punch it.
Okay, you start punching the red thing. It continues to glow and it starts glowing brighter and it's getting hotter as you're punching it. It's going to start burning you if you keep punching it.
I'm going to start burning it.
Okay. Well, then it continues to glow brighter and brighter and brighter.
So do I.
Oh, well, I mean, let's put that aside for a moment. It continues to glow brighter and then it emits.
He left the job.
Spencer just get it back here. Spencer, we need you. He just walked out the back.
Oh my God.
What the fuck?
Dan fell asleep and started snoring, so I'll take over.
What just happened? We lost Spencer. Spencer!
It's a cliffhanger.
I couldn't have been more invested in what was happening.
I know.
Like, he was experiencing a totally different thing.
I think he took the snoring thing as a comment on his dungeon mastering.
Oh, like, yeah. Way to go, Aaron.
What?
All right, so
Aaron McGathy's a bad person. Cliffhanger! Thank you for coming to Harmontown, everybody. Can we give it up one more time for Spencer Crittenden, Aaron McGathy, Dr. Christopher Ryan, and fucking Lorraine Newman, everybody.
Ray Newman!
Garrett Morris!
I am your comptroller, Jeff Davis! And your mayor, Dan Harmon!
Spencer, wherever you are, we love you. Good night, all.
We made him leave. Oh, okay.